This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. On April 20th, 1992, surviving members of Queen, David Bowie, Robert Plant, Axl Rose, and many more converged in on a stadium to perform at a tribute concert to honor one of the greatest singer-songwriters of all time, Freddie Mercury, who passed away on November 24th, 1991. This was in a stadium that in 1992, this week's guest probably never realized he would have also been on that same field. The stadium is pretty famous. It is in London, called Wembley Stadium.
Welcome to the Football History Dude Podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. Your host is Arnie Chapman. Football is his passion, and he wants you to come along with him to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board his DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour. Great
Scott! This time you still have the DeLorean? The date is August 5th, 1993, and we are in London, England. 2 a.m. We're at the lobby of the hotel where the Detroit Lions are staying. We're peering into a conversation between Barry Sanders and this week's guest, Sean Conley. We'll get into that story more in the episode, but it all ties in to one of the reasons why I reached out to Sean. He is a former kicker in the NFL and also for the University of Pittsburgh. His career wasn't what he dreamed of as a kid, but he made it to the show. And then he had a realization that there is more to life than the NFL. And that brings me to this book. It's called The Point After, How One Resilient Kicker Learned There Was More to Life Than the NFL. Now, Sean Conley was that kicker. He had a long journey with different twists and turns and bumps and stuff like that, falling down and coming back up. And now, he lives his best life in a different profession. He started a yoga studio. Well, they had multiple locations. He's a multiple author, a podcast host of a show called Happy Athlete, and among other things, he is a tree ambassador for Community Carbon Trees. And to learn more about Sean and to connect with him, you can learn more over on the show notes portion of this podcast on the Sports History Network. To get there, head to sportshistorynetwork.com/Sean Conley. That's all one word. Sean is spelled S-E-A-N, and Conley is spelled C-O-N-L-E-Y. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/Sean Conley. And if you're listening to this episode before July 16th of 2022, you can sign up to win a free autographed copy of Sean's book, The Point After, How One Resilient Kicker Learned There Was More to Life Than the NFL. And even if it's past July 16th, there's a good chance you can find another giveaway over on the Sports History Network website as well. So head on over there. But without further ado, let's swing into this episode. Get it? Swing with your leg? With Sean Conley. So again, we're going to focus primarily on your book, The Point After, How One Resilient Kicker Learned There Was More to Life Than the NFL. And we're going to get into that. But first, I got to talk to you a little bit about this thing right here. It's a DeLorean. Can you see that in the... The premise of the show is you're going to hop in this DeLorean. You know, this one right here, Doc Emmett Brown, he borrowed it to me so we can go back 88 miles back in time to history. For you specifically, can you take me back to the moment where you said to yourself, all I want to do in life is I want to be a kicker in the NFL. And where did that come from?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And by the way, one of my favorite movies. So this is perfect. And actually I'm thinking the movie came out in 85, but
Hey, I was only 3 months old about when it came out. So yeah, it's like a near and dear type of thing to my heart. I mean, we could go on and on. The listener of the show has heard ad nauseum my fandom for the movie series. So
yeah, I was actually 15 at the time, but yeah. So to answer your question. So for me, like growing up, my father, I grew up in Erie, Pennsylvania, which was and still is like a huge sports town. And the world that I was living in too, like I really felt like that's, life was all about sports. So my father was a three sport athlete. He was offered a minor league contract with the Pittsburgh Pirates. So he was like my superhero, like super sports hero growing up. And, you know, I played a multitude of sports, and one day it was my dad's idea. He said, hey, let's do, punt, pass, and kick. And that was like this new competition that I think came out like in the 70s. So this is around like 1980. I'm about, like 9 or 10 years old. And, you know, he says, I think you got a strong leg. You should just give it a shot. I had no idea really what it was all about. We hopped into our metallic blue station wagon with, you know, no seat belts, and away we went out to the country. And, I did this competition, you know, the punt, the pass, the kick. And I just was hooked on the kicking part. It was, you know, something I really didn't know I had this skill for. Well, I wouldn't say skill, because actually of the three things I did, I did the worst kicking. It was more just like a love and a passion for it. And so, you know, from that day on, I just love kicking the football. And most of my training was just like out in the street. Like growing up in Erie, we'd have these crazy snowstorms, and our street was a quiet street. So I'd go out in the street and just, you know, squish the ball into the soft snow and just like kick it back and forth, and, you know, until the streetlights came on, you know, until I had to go back in. So I just, you know, my kicking just was, you know, for the most part, just like fun and playing until I got, you know, realized I need to get a little bit more serious and regimented about it. And, you know, when I got in high school.
So, okay, let's go to Erie. Well, before I get into the football thing, we got a guy on the network, Pigskin Dispatch, Darren Hayes. He's also from Erie, Pennsylvania. So let's give him a shout out first. But second of all, if I head to Erie to go visit Darren, what restaurant should I take him to?
You know, Darren was actually, I'm sorry, before I forget the question about the restaurant is, the name of my street was Stafford Avenue, and we had something called the Stafford Football League. Yeah. So we actually had a draft, you know, we had teams and everything, and it was for the most part like 3-on-3. And, we actually played tackle football in the street, and we were able to do this because the snow did get so high in the street. It was like there was a layer, like 4 or 5 inches, and the snow got so high on the sides that was like the out of bounds. So you could tackle kids into the snow piles. It was crazy. So, you know, we had a playoffs, Super Bowl, the whole thing. But you know, Erie has a ton of Italian restaurants. I don't know if it's still there, but my favorite was Hector's. I don't know how Erie was able to get away with this, and they still can. They actually put restaurants in homes. You'd be just driving down like a random residential street, and there's a restaurant, an Italian restaurant or a bar in what looks like just like a house. And it was just, you know, something that of zoning they must have did at some point, and they kept it, but like it was all over. Like, you know, just in my little residential neighborhood, there was like 4 or 5 Italian restaurants that we could walk to, and bars that were just right there. It was something unique to Erie.
So I get it. Hector's is what you gave it. Give a look.
Hector's, right? Yeah.
All right, yeah, we'll have to talk to Darren about that someday next time I speak to him, see if there is a Hector still out there. And that's, it sounds like you guys almost like had arena / hockey football before it was even really a biggest thing.
Yeah, and then, well, we also made hockey goals out of 2x4s, and we put sheets too. So, like, you know, we would also just, you know, slide out hockey goals, and then when the cars would come down, we'd slide them to the side and bring them back in. You know, like Erie, unfortunately, you know, it doesn't get the winners like they did. There was so much snow from like November, December through March that, you know, we could play our tackle football right in the street.
So you were in the middle of, I guess, three different major NFL franchises. Which of the three would you have been a fan of?
Yeah, I actually grew up a diehard Cleveland Browns fan. So Buffalo is the closest. It's like 80 miles from Erie, 86 miles. But at the time, you know, the Browns had such a rich tradition, you know, in the 60s and 50s. So like growing up with like in the 70s and 80s, there were still like a lot of Browns fan. And then Steelers, so I'd say like it's like 50-50. My dad would take me to a Cleveland Browns game. You know, usually twice a year, we'd sit in the wooden bleachers and the dog pound, and he would take me. I'd be like 7, 8, 9 years old, and I can't believe he took me to the dog pound, because I would, you know, hear words I never heard of, and you know, everyone's like smoking pot in there. I mean, it was the dog pound. I would go when they, you know, had the you know, the guy with the dog face and all that. It was hardcore.
So I was actually kind of hoping you would have said the Bills, because it would have been that perfect segue for a podcast. Pete Gogolak and one of the reasons why the NFL and NFL had their war there and ended up coming together.
Right.
But, you know, okay, so let's go back. You said you talked to your childhood. Let's get now into the story of bringing you into, I guess you could say, your kicking in that kind of career. As a youngster, you know, you said you were diagnosed with ADHD in the book. How did that affect your career as a kicker, maybe positive or negative?
Yeah, great question, because actually the answer is both positive and negative. You know, so growing up with ADD, I was able to channel it very well. So, you know, for me, that was how I could, like, get out of my head, so to speak, was kicking. But where it became very challenging for me is because I would get so much in my head. So when I wasn't kicking, before I'd kick or after I'd kick, you know, I would think that I needed to do more. I needed to train more. I needed, like, when I would kick, you know, because of the ADD and the way my mind thought, I thought I had to kick like a certain amount of balls and I couldn't quit. So that for most of my career, I wasn't very intuitive as a kicker, which is something like you definitely need. So that didn't come later on in my career, but like I would have a notepad and I would kick, you know, five on the left hash from the 25 yard line, five in the middle, five on the right. And I'd just keep going back and I just would keep kicking. You know, like no matter how fatigued I felt, I would just keep kicking until I hit those numbers. So it certainly helped me because I improved dramatically and, you know, I trained hard, but what it did, and I didn't know this till later, is by the time I was 25, I had a leg of probably a kicker who was like, you know, was like 45, because I just put in too many reps. And it wasn't until like toward the end of my NFL career where I realized it was more about quality over quantity. But by then I'd already done the damage to my leg, hip and back at that point.
If that even happened to you ever, with that, did the freezing ever phase you, like when they freeze a kicker?
No. I luckily for me, you know, like, and I don't even know like why this is, but I never had an issue with like freezing or playing in front of large crowds. And I don't, it wasn't like a training that got that. It's just for whatever reason, and I think, you know, for kickers, we just don't find this out till we start to kick in these situations. It just, I was always, for the most part, pretty relaxed in those situations. And I think what that had to do with is just, you know, when I would train, I did a lot of visualization. You know, I just like learned this from other kickers. Gary Anderson was with the Steelers when I was at Pitt, and I remember him talking about it. And so I would use a lot of that where I would just, and I didn't realize that this was like, you know, like visualization at the time. I don't remember even Gary Anderson talking about it. He would just, you know, be more specific. And I would just spend a lot of time like in the hotel room visualizing like what I was going to do on the field. And I would spend a lot of time in the locker room, like just, you know, sitting by myself, or like not by myself, but just like not talking to anyone, doing the same thing. And then also on the sidelines too, when we'd be moving into field goal position, I'd start to like just, you know, picture my mind past kicks that I had made and try to really get that in my mind. So when I stepped on the field, the only thing I was thinking about was just was making a kick.
You know, this is like episode, I don't know, 7 or 8, whatever it was when I was doing solo episodes. I remember researching Jim Thorpe, you know, one of the greatest athletes of all time. And when he was on the boat over to the 1912 Olympics, he was taking what they thought was a nap, but he was closing his eyes. And, I can't remember who the coach's name was, but came up and said, "Hey, Jim, you sleeping?" He's, "No, I'm just visualizing myself doing, you know, whatever the different ones, hurdles," or 'cause he did the decathlon. So it was like, well, he didn't realize what he was doing back then too, but that's basically what he was.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, so he's totally ahead of his time then. Yeah. It probably didn't have a name at the time, but he was doing it.
Yeah, I mean, probably because he was Native American by birth, and they attributed it to, and I'm butchering it probably, but I think they attributed it to some of his spiritual tapping into that from there. But then again, he was taken away from his home like very early in life and brought all the way to, well, geez, Pennsylvania. It was Eastern Pennsylvania for Carlisle there. Let's mentors. We'll talk about that. Let's bounce into as you come into college, or do you have any like memorable moments from high school before we jump into college?
Yeah, I actually didn't play in high school. That, you know, my plan was when I went to my high school that they were going to have a football team starting my sophomore year, but then it turned out, you know, for whatever reason that it got squashed because of budget or what have you. So I was actually thinking about transferring to the other school in town. that had a football team. But right around that same time was when you started to see this huge influx of NFL kickers that also didn't play like high school. Some didn't even play college. Like you had Morton Anderson, you know, soccer player, Matt Barr, you know, so you had all those type of kickers because the shift was happening from, you know, the straight on kicking, you know, those kickers were considered like the dinosaurs. And now like it was all the soccer style. Most of the soccer style kickers at the time were European who had just, you know, they had no high school football team. So I just thought, hey, I like my position. I like playing the other sports here because I also played basketball and soccer, which I really enjoyed. So I thought, hey, I think I could do the same thing. I'll just keep training, you know, kicking field goals on the side, and then I'll walk on somewhere because, you know, most kickers, don't get scholarships. They still don't now. They certainly didn't get back then. I figured I'd just walk on, and that became my plan to just eventually walk on to a college and hopefully make the NFL from there.
You know, I didn't even realize, like, so like Morton Anderson, for instance, you know, a name, one of the biggest kickers, period, that anyone's ever heard of. I didn't know he was a walk-on. I didn't know that.
No, I don't know if he was a walk-on. He went to Michigan State, but I don't think he played soccer in high school. Not 100%, but there was just so many guys at the time. I remember just watching them on TV thinking, you know, like, hey, if this guy can just show up and kick, because it is, I thought, hey, it's pretty simple. All I have to do is kick, you know, kick the ball. So, you know, why do I need to really be on the team? Actually, I ran into, you know, Dan Marino when I was at Pitt. He was in for like our annual blue gold game, and they bring in like the big alumni for that. And I ran into him at a bar, and he, I was sitting next to him talking to him. He just said, hey, I got some advice for you. Cause, you know, I told him like, you know, I was a senior and I was hoping to play in the NFL. And he says, you have one job. Kick the ball. That's it. Just kick the fucking ball. That was like Dan Marino's thing. Like, that's it. And, you know, it's funny. He was half joking, half serious. But like, you know, that's really it. It's just really simple. And, you know, as kickers, like we have one job, but like there's more to it for sure. But like, you know, just you know, keep it simple behind the scenes is kind of what I took from that.
Yeah. I mean, that is really you break down the mechanics of it. Sure. You're just like swinging your leg and hitting a ball and it's going in or out. And that's really, but yeah, I know there's a lot more involved. So let's do that. Maybe take me through whatever your routine was, but you're on the sidelines. It's 3rd and 15. You know, you're probably going to get up there because it's at the 38 yard line. Like, what goes through your mind? And then maybe up until the time the ball is going through the post.
Yeah. So, you know, once we cross the 50, that's usually when, you know, most kickers start to move over to the net. And, you know, that's what I would do. You know, for me, I would only take just a few strokes at the kicking net. Cause I think if you start too soon with that kicking net, you know, there's penalties going back and forth. Next thing you know, you're at that kicking net for like 15 minutes. So usually for me, you know, I would wait to almost like the last minute, like once we're third down, I get a couple kicks, really second down. Usually once we're inside, like the 40, I get a couple and that's it. Cause then once it gets to third down, the most teams will call it like, you know, get in the box and be ready. You know, but for me, it's, you know, I just try to like stay away from everybody and, you know, like try to stand to the side, like usually when we go out there. And the same thing, like once I'd get out there, you know, just get right my position, and then just, you know, my eyes would, you know, immediately just go to the goalpost and just, you know, just do everything to, just to block everything out and just try to make it my own little island. And, you know, the players are always pretty supportive of like that. They know the same thing. They don't want to go near you either. So, you know, other than your holder, you know, and then that's it. So like you have your little battery, it's a holder, the snapper and the kicker. And those are usually the only guys that I would have any sort of interaction with before a kick.
So your holder, like in general, say like going in at Pitt. Well, first let's give him and the snapper. Let's give them both shout outs on the show. What were their names?
Yeah. John Ryan and Lou Casanova. And John Ryan was of all the holders I had. And I had some really good holders. Actually, Jim Harbaugh was the holder when I was with the Colts, but, he was really good, but John Ryan was the best. And the reason why he was the best, you know, everyone makes that, you know, the joke about Finkel with like laces out, like this guy, I every single rep, whether it was game or practice, he always had the laces out. And, you know, the thing with the kickers and the whole laces is, you could still kick the ball when the laces are facing you, but there's that psychological thing when you see those laces facing you where it's just like, oh shit. And but if you have a kicker that no matter how, or a holder, no matter how he gets it, he can get that ball spun. And because there's a huge element of just having confidence in your holder. And it's I don't want to say like it's a lost art, but you know that you know quarterbacks used to always be trained on that. That's really not the case as much as it used to be. You know, a lot of teams now really struggle to find that right holder. And you know, some kids, you know, that's how they can how they have a job. You know, in a lot of these in the NFL now, like you know, you hear some teams they'll keep a certain quarterback. They can't make a decision for you know who's going to be the third string quarterback. A lot of time it comes down to which backup quarterback is a good holder, because it's really hard. I mean, from the time the ball is snapped. You know, that kick has to be away in 1.2 seconds. So when the holder gets the ball and he puts, like, there's no margin for error. He can't move it around or anything, and he can't half spin it. You know, if he half spins it, like it's that doesn't do it. Like the spin has to be perfect for the laces out, and it's just and then you have to have he has to have the right tilt. You know, all kickers have different tilts that they want. Like for me, the ball was almost straight up and down and just slightly tilted towards him. And, you know, not all holders are able to get that perfect like that. So, because like the sweet spot for the kicker is the size of like a button, like a nickel. And so if that ball is tilted back a little bit, then that sweet spot now has like completely changed. So it's so hard. Like when you watch these games in the NFL and the kick misses, and I'm not saying it's not always a kicker's fault, but like if, you know, there's little things like that that can change the trajectory of a kick, especially when you get beyond like, 35, 40 yards, little things like that, like how the ball is tilted. You know, if the kicker just slightly misses like the bullseye of that nickel size sweet spot, you know, or if his foot isn't in the perfect angle hitting the sweet spot, you know, the ball can move a couple feet to the right and then it hits a goal post or it goes wide and that's it. So there's very little margin for error and all that. And again, this all has to happen under 1.2 seconds.
So I have two follow-up questions revolving the team, the trio then. Is it, you know, I guess I never even thought about this. Do special teams coordinators, once they find that trio, like, do they try to do their best to keep them together then?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, like, I'm just thinking back to Pitt, like we had a backup holder and a backup snapper. And if you were to just take one of them out, the difference was huge. Like the drop down in, not the word talent, but just in like efficiency and confidence, you know? So like, so there's a couple times like, you know, during some practice weeks where Lou, the snapper was having issues with his shoulders and different, centers came in and it's just a little bit different. Like the rhythm's just off a little bit. And you'll see that in games too. Like when you see like, oh, the long snapper's out and someone else is in and like, you know, next thing you know, the long snapper goes over, you know, snaps it over the holder's head. It's really hard. That's the other thing too. Like he has to whip that snap back and it has to be like in that perfect spiral. And, you know, it's not an easy skill and nobody ever talks about the long snapper unless he sails it over the guy's head.
Yeah, actually I feel so bad about it right now, but there was a Lions is a Don Molbach. He was one of our longtime special team snappers. And I always read that he was one of the better, and I don't know if he was with Hanson. We'll get into that later with Jason Hanson and your running mate there with the rookies. But I was just always curious, like how much of a difference, like, is it 15 yards between the kicker and the snapper and the holder?
Yeah, so field goal is like 7 to 8, depends on like the kicker's trajectory. Like if he's someone who can get the ball up, you know, high and quick, then it's closer to 7. If he's someone who has a little bit lower trajectory, then they're better off at 8. And then the punt is usually around 14 to 15.
That must be what I'm thinking of as the punt then. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I mean, like, okay, you're talking 7 to 8 yards, like, how much of a percentage change, how much better can like one snapper be than the next, just from a pure trajectory standpoint?
Yeah. I mean, usually the biggest difference is that time to get at 1.2. Like, you know, if his rhythm of, if he doesn't whip it back quite as quick, like this is what happens. Sometimes you'd have a backup snapper who it just didn't go as quick as the starting guy. So because of that, you sometimes felt like you had to make up for that. So maybe you'd kind of inch and like get ready to start a little quicker because you know you had to do 1.2 like the kick wasn't going to get off. You know, the problem with it, with the whole 1.2 is especially, you know, you have the guys on the corner who is so fast, and then you also have the penetration up the middle. So that's sometimes you would adjust with that. If the guy was a little bit slower, the backup, sometimes that's when you'd move it back. Okay, we're going to do 8 yards because we know the snap isn't going to be as fast. This will give us a better chance to get the kick off, even though now the kick is 1 yard longer.
Yeah, you played back before they made some of those rules too, like jumping on the center's back and all those other things. Did you ever have that where someone just jumped, like came stone cold over the center and all you have is a body?
No, I never had that, but I had plenty of games where I'd look out there and, some teams, like they'll have a guy who like his job is, you know, 'cause he's just so tall, like in the middle. And then sometimes when you'd line up and, you know, I'd take like 3 steps back, 2 over, and I'd look and you're looking at the goalpost, but the guy is just so big. You just can't help but to see him. And you just kind of like, do your thing, kick it the way you normally do, and it'll go over his hands. But like you look at some of those guys that they put out there on the kick block, and they're just, you know, the height on some of them is unbelievable. And a lot of them can jump too. Like, you know, they'll find these, some teams will use like someone who's like a 6'6" wide receiver, 6'5" wide receiver, and they can jump and you'll see them like, you know, start to approach. You're like, oh man, I got to get this ball up quick.
Yeah, it's just funny, the little nuances and subtleties, the game within the game within the game. And I mean, when you watch it on TV, it's like, okay, it just happens. And it's either goes up or down. Like you said, you only remember when they miss, or like, of course, my nemesis, I love Justin Tucker because he's so good. But yeah, of course, against my Detroit Lions, has a break the record like that last year.
Yeah, he's unbelievable. He actually has, I think, one of the best quotes about being a kicker. I think he was on 60 Minutes, as a matter of fact, like a handful of months ago. And they asked him, you know, about the art of kicking. And he said kicking is 90% mental and the other 10% is also mental. which is so true. I mean, once you get to that level, at the NFL level, like physically, you know, you obviously have the skills because you had to go through, you know, the workouts that eventually they signed you or drafted you or what have you. Now that all the, you know, the kickers now are going to be separated by who can, because you're going to miss. Every kicker is going to miss at some point. Who can bounce back the quickest? I always thought that was, you know, when you look at a lot of kickers, like that's really the art. Not getting down on yourself because it's going to happen. All the good ones miss at some point.
Yeah, I always kind of liken it to like a pitcher that gives up a home run, but then you just got to get back up there and throw it to that number four hitter right after it.
Exactly.
Okay, so Justin Tucker, and granted, I'm not taking away from the kick, but it was in a dome. How much of at what point does weather play an issue, like affecting the kick?
Oh yeah, it makes a huge difference. I think if you were to look at the list of the longest field goals made, I'm fairly certain most of them, exception of the Tom Dempsey, which looked like it was like kicked on dirt, but a lot of them are in domes, and a lot of them are in places where the air is thinner, such as like Denver. So that makes a big difference. You know, most of the kicking that I did was like in Pittsburgh, which is it's pretty challenging here. Like even when I played at Pitt, you know, we had that artificial turf at the time, but it's just like the wind and the cold makes a huge difference. Not only just on the trajectory of the ball, but like the colder the air, like the ball is not going to go as far. You know, so if you're in a place that's warm, a place that's controlled, now you can hit it really far consistently. You know, Morten Andersen, he's famous for, this is just my guess why he did it. I had a friend, when I was playing, he was with the Dolphins at the time, and he was playing against Morten Andersen. I think it was a preseason game, and Morten Andersen would put the ball on the 50 yard line and he would kick a 60 yarder in one direction. And he'd turn around standing right at the 50 again and kick a 60 yarder in the other direction. And he would just go back and forth making 60 yarders. This is down in the Superdome. And I think it was just to psych out the kicker, because my buddy, the other kicker for the Dolphins, he was just like, man, I was just so humbled. And he was always in his own league. But you know, Morten Andersen was so good and so strong. I think no matter where he kicked, he would have been successful. But yeah, it definitely helps to have that controlled environment.
I mean, that's why we'll go to, again, talked about my guy, Jason Hansen, but the, Patriots, and he played for the Colts, Vinatieri. Have that much accuracy for that long is just very impressive up in the New England area.
Oh yeah. No. Yeah. I think you can make a case that he's the best of all time, given what he did there. And he's unbelievable. It was weird because both, I started playing in the 90s, and it was just like 4 or 5 years ago that Vinatieri, who was also in the league at the same time, came in around the same time I did, and so did Jason Hansen. They both actually just retired in the last 5 years because they made it to their mid to late 40s, which was always a goal for mine that I wanted to kick that long, but I burned out way, way too soon. I didn't even come close to that. But and I think that just had a lot to do with how they took care of their bodies at an earlier stage in their career. I know for, Adam Vinatieri, you know, luckily for him, his career wasn't, it wasn't like he was like a big time, power five kicker. I believe he was South Dakota State or something like that. And I think he didn't start kicking until college. And, you know, Jason Hansen too was just someone who just had some just amazing flexibility and just, you know, the way his body was built. When he would do warm up kicks, you know, without a ball, like his leg would go all the way up towards his head. I was just built much differently like that. I was more of like a puncher kicker, more like the style of like Morten Andersen, where like my leg wouldn't go back very far and it wouldn't go up very far. It was just, luckily for me that my technique worked, like how I struck the ball, but I was just very, very tight, and so my body over time didn't handle that very well. But Jason Hansen was just, you know, the way his body was built, and also just he had like insane focus, and he was such like a attention to detail that and he was unflappable too, you know, on and off the field. Like if you just talk to him on the sidelines, like he just was like, he reminded me of like I always thought like when I first saw him, he looked like Richie Cunningham from like Happy Days. Like he was just like cool and happy and smooth, and like he never got too high, never got too low, and never got frustrated. Like in practice, I remember one day he was missing a bunch, like a bunch for him would be like two, and it just didn't bother him. He just knew exactly what he did wrong, and like the next kick, you know. So he was just, you know, very skilled. Did a lot of video work too, which is unusual for some kickers.
Yeah, he was. I mean, I bring that up because listener of the show knows I'm a big Lions fan. And Jason, like growing up, he was my own. I know Eddie Murray was there before, but I was too young. Yep. But it was Jason Hansen like my entire life long time. And another guy that growing up, I only knew this guy. Let's talk about him here in a little bit. You know, you had some interactions with him too. But so Jason Hansen came in the same year as you, right?
Oh, no. So 2 years before me. Actually, I think about it. Wow. So, yeah, even 2 years before. So, when I came to Detroit, he had just signed, which was at the time the largest, he was the highest paid kicker of all time at that time. And I think he signed for like maybe $725 or $750 per year, which at that time was insane to give a kicker. I don't think any kickers before that got $500. But he was... He was in the, you know, he was hitting so many bombs. You know, he hit a lot of bombs when he was at Washington State too. I think I know he was drafted. I forget how high he was drafted, but you know, he came in and, you know, for his first 2 years in the NFL, he was unbelievable. So he was super high paid. Yeah. So when I went to Detroit, I knew that there was, you know, when they brought me in, it was like, hey, like, you know, you're here in case Jason gets hurt. So, but it wasn't a bad deal because they said to me, hey, you're here if Jason gets hurt, but like, we're going to guarantee you, playing time, which for kickers is valuable because they said like, you'll have video and, you know, you'll be able to send this to other teams. And that's how I made my decision. I also had, tryouts with it or offers from the Steelers and the Arizona Cardinals, but, the Detroit went beyond like, hey, we'll just bring in the training camp. We'll be in the training camp and, you know, we don't want Jason kicking every day in practice. So there'll be days where you'll be the kicker, which was great too, because we'd have a lot of scrimmages and I was like just the kicker. And then I got playing time in preseason and they were right. And that's what really, really helped me because then after I got cut by Detroit, I was able to sign the next year with the Colts. So that it was my experience in Detroit that got my was able to get me to the next step. So it's always, you know, how a lot of kickers look at who I sign with. It's not to necessarily win that job, but then go to the next place. And then when I was with the Colts, I had a really, really good chance to win that job.
Yeah, I mean, on the book, that's what it has, you in your Colts uniform sitting on the side, or not sitting, but standing on the sideline there. And okay, one of the questions I was going to ask, you've already kind of answered it, was have you ever played in a preseason game? Check. Second, that means if you were with the Lions, so that meant you kicked in the Silverdome then, huh?
Right. Oh yeah, the good old Pontiac Silverdome, no longer, unfortunately. And it was growing up, watching that Detroit Lion game on Thanksgiving Day, like it was surreal when I first played in that. Cause I'm like, wow, this is, cause I was always like a big fan of like quintessential, 70s, 80s, football. And that's, the Lions were always part of that, like my mom would make Thanksgiving, lunch, we'd have the game on in the other room, we'd go in, we'd watch it, fall asleep during halftime, watch the rest of it. And so like, get to play there was so surreal. And, cause I always love the Detroit Lions uniforms, the blue, and then to get there. And also they had so many stars at the time too, beyond Jason Hansen, there was Chuck Long, there was Rodney Peete. And of course there was, in my opinion, the best running back of all time, along with Walter Payton, was Barry Sanders, who just, watching him even in practice, it was like, wow, this guy is just, there's nobody there. He's got his own thing.
Yeah, I mean, let's get into that. So at practice, you did something that growing up as a kid at Detroit, Michigan, Barry Sanders fan, Detroit. I mean, I probably had more Barry Sanders jerseys than, you wore a pair of socks in your life. But so you got to play catch with this guy. How did that come to be? Like, how did that happen?
I still don't know. My theory was always just, it was because Barry Sanders is just who he is, which is humble. Doesn't like the spotlight. So it was like the second or third practice. It was really early in training camp. And so like before practice would begin, we'd go out early and everyone would do their own little warm-ups and whatever it was. And so a lot of guys played catch. So he came up to me, he had a football in his hand. Well, I see him starting walking towards me, like, oh man, this Barry Sanders is walking towards me. What could he possibly want to talk with me? Because you get that sense when you're in training camp, because you first come in, there's 80 guys. And then there's a cut, and you get down around 60, and then down to 45. And so you kind of think to yourself, are any of these players even going to talk to us, knowing that a lot of us are going to be gone or whatever? And a lot of players wouldn't, because they got that sense, like you're just not going to be around. But he starts walking over to me, and he's like, hey, do you want to play catch? And I'm like, wait, really? Barry Sanders? And I'm looking at him. And the crazy thing, I was taller than him. I couldn't believe it. But like his thighs were like four of mine. And, he just has this just amazing, for being a player who just plays so hard and so passionate, he was just so like such a relaxed guy. And then we played catch. And the next day, it was the same thing. I met at practice, he just starts throwing me the ball. And then every day before practice began for the next 5 weeks, 6 weeks or whatever it was, I'd play catch with Barry Sanders before practice. So it was just another surreal moment that probably one of my favorite moments of being in the NFL, probably even more memorable than the playing time when I had some.
Was this like when you were playing catch, like you're sitting there chatting too, or is it mostly just throwing the ball around?
Yeah, a little bit of chatting, not much, it was just, I think, that's what I say. Like my theory is I think the reason why he did it would play catch with me and it's just because he was someone who just, was not big on the spotlight. So he just would do his own thing. And he was just there to do the work. He seemed to be a guy he'd rather be around, just run of the mill players like myself. So yeah. And then, I did get a chance to speak with him, a few more times. I actually had a really personal conversation with him when we went to London. This is when the NFL was first, maybe this was the second year where they're trying to market to Europe, and we were playing the Dallas Cowboys in London. And the first few nights, our coach Wayne Fonts, he was just like, okay, tonight you guys can go out, you can be out till, four. And then the next night it's three, and then it's two. So this was maybe the third night, it's supposed to be back around two. And I did what all rookies do. And, you know, go to the pubs and all the other thing. And, you know, like, I remember, like, you know, the Dallas Cowboy Cheerleaders had a party. So, like, you know, we had to go to that. And it was just, you know, all that, you know, stuff that, you know, I don't know if it's, it was in my best interest. But anyways, I come walking back into the lobby at two, and I see Barry Sanders sitting in the lobby, and he's reading like a little Stephen King book or something like that. And I came down, sat down next to him, and I remember telling him, like, hey, I'm really, somehow the conversation turned to, like, you know, to the cuts, where we're like, which maybe I think like 2 weeks away. And I said something about them. He said, hey, whatever you do, whatever happens with your career, remember that there's more to life than the NFL, which is where I got the subtitle for my book. And I remember when he said that, I can't believe I didn't believe him. I didn't believe his words, because for me at that time, I really felt like that was it. Like, the only way, like, my goal, my life would be fulfilled is if I did, like, have a long, successful career in the NFL. But, no, he was certainly right. And I think that's why, like, when he retired early, that I wasn't surprised. I kind of connected the dots. Like, I think there must have been a certain point for him. And I know that a lot of it had to do with the contract and the management and so forth. But I think, you know, he made a decision. A lot of athletes don't, which is, like, he went out on his own terms because, you know, he knew he had more in his life beyond, you know, running around on a football field.
Yeah, and I can appreciate that more now as I got older. But as a youngster, I mean, you don't want to say, like, you immortalize him. But, I mean, as a kid, I did. I mean, I immortalized Barry Sanders. I was him in the backyard. I didn't remember any time in my life because he was so durable, too. I remember no games, basically, that I can recall. And then it happened. And I kind of blame Michael Jordan for this because Michael came back after he retired. So I'm like, hey, Barry will come back. And I just remembered I, like, cried as a kid. It just, you know, it was just one of those things. But again, I like how he gave you, I mean, ultimately the title of the book, but there is more life than football, because that's hard for athletes to transition, especially when, like, it's your pinnacle, I guess you could call it, because the NFL, like, there's no other place to go other than, I guess, you can get the Hall of Fame. But, like, that is the top of that type of sport, and you're essentially out of it at, what, your 30s, if you're lucky, mostly in your early mid-20s kind of thing. Now, I was just say, before we get into, like, maybe some of the other stuff that's beyond the NFL career, we didn't get a chance to give a shout out and love to your coach, Amos Jones. I just wanted, how did he impact your life?
Oh, huge. Yeah. I mean, if it wasn't for Amos, there's no way I would have had a successful season at the University of Pittsburgh or been able to do what I was able to do at the NFL level. I got really lucky when I went to Pitt because I was a walk-on, a transfer walk-on. There was already four guys that were on scholarship. And so when I first went there, I was like, and actually there's a couple other walk-ons too. So I was like sixth or seventh on the depth chart when I first got there. But lucky for me, it was also Amos Jones's first year. And the crazy thing about Amos, he's still coaching. He's actually still coaching in the NFL right now. Because he was also an outsider like me, he didn't care about the guys that were already on scholarship. He was just like, who's the best guy? And I think because of that, we connected. And also he was from Alabama, and this was, you know, college football was a lot more regional back in the, you know, the 80s and 90s. So most of our coaching staff was from Pennsylvania and Ohio and you know, the Northeast and the Midwest. And so he was you know, coming from Alabama, and he had, like, you know, Southern draw, like, if you like, for players, you know, coming from Philadelphia and from the, you know, the country of, you know, like, me from Erie, like, you know, who is this guy? And I think because of, you know, us both being outsiders, we really connected. And I think he just, you know, just appreciated that I just, you know, just like the work ethic, that I brought to it. And, where he really helped me was, because I had no coaching up to this time at all. Like, I was completely self-trained. What really helped me take my game to, like, to the level of like where I needed to be, which, you know, eventually got me like some NFL signings, was when I was in the film room at the time. This comes back to your question about the ADD. I was really hypercritical of myself in the film room. So I'd watch it. And whenever I'd see myself, like, make a bad kick, I would just, like, watch it over and over again, like, where my plant foot was and my follow through and all that stuff. And I keep rewinding and watching the same thing. And I remember one day he walked into the video room and he shouted at me. He's like, no, you know, that's not what you do. And then he started giving me this whole story, because, you know, Amos always had stories. And you know, because he played for Bear Bryant. So we go, here we go again. Here's one of his Bear Bryant stories. He always had to remind me that he played for Bear Bryant and he coached with the Bears. And he's like, so he goes, after our games at Alabama, he'd bring the whole team into the meeting room. We'd all be in the video room. And he said he'd put up on the tape, you know, up the video screen of like the previous game, like let's say it was against like Auburn, whatever. And he would show for the first few minutes, okay, we need to get better here, we need to get better there. But then he said that Bear Bryant would then spend the next, you know, 45 minutes or the rest of the training session was all positive plays. Oh, you know, like look what you did. Yeah, that, you know, he would just like go through, like they'd keep showing these plays. He'd be like, yeah, this. And he said the reason why he did that is like he wanted to drive into these guys' heads, you know, back to this like whole visualization. These are the plays that you did, that you saw, and then this is what we're going to do again next week. And so he always reinforced that. So he said, you need to do the same thing with your kicking. You know, if you got video of 10 kicks and the two screw-ups or whatever, yeah, recognize what you did, get better. Now watch over and over again, you know, from previous games and practice the kicks that you hit perfectly. And he said, you need to get that into your head. And then that's it. And so this really helped me because for my next year at Pitt and a few years in the NFL, like, you know, I would miss and I'd have, you know, and so like, what do I do now? And so that really helped me whenever I'd have like a miss or two to like, okay, hey, come back to like, you know, look at some positive kicks here or use that visualization. Keep that going. That helped me get over a lot of humps.
Yeah, I didn't realize that's one thing that Bear Bryant did, but like again, one ahead of his time for a check about a million boxes. But that conversation now about focusing on the positive and, you know, getting to the outcomes that you want to be to get there. And yes, you got to recognize, like you said, the negative thing that happened or perceived negative thing, because you can always turn it down to a positive thing. But that thing that happened didn't go the way you wanted it to. Let's learn from it, move on, and let's focus on what we did well, so then we can continue to build upon it. I think nowadays is a more prevalent conversation, or at least it's more recognized. It's easier. What's the best way to put it? It's not demonized maybe by the masses like it used to be. And let's just get into that. Happy athlete. What's the purpose and the expectations the listener can have from your podcast, Happy Athlete?
Yeah. So it's a mix of a couple things. Some of the guests I have on are like our former athletes, and, you know, my interest in having them on is just to talk about more of like, the highs and the lows, like overcoming challenges. We tap into a little bit, like, you know, like some of their mental health challenges that they work with. And then also, I deal with a lot of, like meditation, you know, like, you know, luckily these days, you know, meditation is something that's super accepted, like almost to the point now, if you plan on like playing at a super high level of any sport, there has to be some meditation, in your game. Like when I played, like meditation, yoga, if you did any of that stuff, like you were soft. If you admitted to any weakness to your coach, I remember when I was with the Colts and I was feeling that I was just taking a lot of reps during training camp one time because the veteran wanted to take a break. So like for 3 or 4 days, I was just doing all the reps and I wanted to go down and tell the coach that I wanted to take a break. But there was just, you know, you just didn't do that then because it was just like, you know, you're a wimp if you did that. So, you know, nowadays like that is completely shifted. So, you know, the show deals with a lot about like, you know, just finding balance in sports, but also balance in your life. And that's really where, we have discussions on like, meditation and a little bit of talk about yoga, but it's more about just, finding ways to, you know, tools and skills that can be used when, you know, whether you're an athlete or not an athlete, to just help your mind.
So in there, I mean, you can give me two if you want, but like what, one of the interviews that you spoke to one of these individuals, and I don't know, the story hit you like a ton of bricks, open your eyes to a new path, or whatever you want to call it. Like what's one story if you could pick one out?
It would probably be the one I had. I had Mike Adams on the show, who's a Pittsburgh Steeler. If you're like a Big Ten football fan, you'd know the name. He was the number two high school recruit back in maybe 2010, somewhere around there. Anyways, he was drafted by the Steelers, super high draft pick. He was his third year in the NFL, and he one night was stabbed, and he was stabbed in the stomach. I don't know if you remember. Remember when this happened? It happened outside a bar here in Pittsburgh, and so his whole, his abdominal muscles were shot. And so this was a guy who, you know, number one or number two high school recruit, number one draft pick by the Pittsburgh Steelers, and his body was never the same. So his story was really powerful because he just got in a really, really dark place. And, his whole identity was football. And so, he wasn't able to go out on his own terms. So he just shares some really good insight about, you know, coming to grips the reality of something that he didn't control his whole life. You know, he's going to be, you know, all this money he lost, his whole career, his something that he, had worked for his whole life, and then how he was able to move on from that and change his life. He's actually, ironically, now he's also a yoga and meditation teacher, because that's what he found helped him get through some of the darkest parts of, like, when he knew his career was over. Because, you know, once he came back to the Steelers and he had healed, it didn't matter, because his body was never the same. You know, his body, if you saw him, he looked like, wow, this is an exceptional athlete. But, like, now to be at the NFL level, you know, now he's down a notch. So it's just it's not going to work. And that's such a shame for so many NFL players who have injuries. If they are now just a teeny bit not what they were when they first signed with the team, that's the difference between, you know, being on a roster and, you know, now finding something new to do with your life.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a war of attrition when it comes to that. I mean, you're with the top 1% of the 1% of the 1% of athletes, and just that little bit of losing an edge, unfortunately, you know, it's hard to maintain your roster space there. Speaking of that, like, that's perfect into, like, what you dealt with throughout your career in the book. I mean, let's give the listener of the show the name of the book once more time.
Oh, yeah, thanks. It's called The Point After: How One Resilient Kicker Learned There's More to Life Than the NFL.
And then the name of the podcast with Happy.
Happy Athlete.
If the listener wants to learn more about both of those things, what's the best way to go ahead and get a hold of you or find you, website, all that type of stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. My website is seanconley.net. I'm also on Instagram and Twitter.
And then we'll put links in the show notes for everybody to look in that. Speaking of the website, so there's one thing that I saw in there that I don't know if the listener is interested in this, but there's an opportunity to head to Costa Rica with you for a retreat. What's that all about?
Thanks for the plug. Yes, my wife and I, we do yoga retreats around the world. We usually do a couple, 2 to 3 a year, sometimes Italy, Mexico. But yeah, we're doing one in Costa Rica. And what it is we do a couple of yoga classes a day. Everything's super optional. So a lot of people come down, let's do one yoga class, and then we just eat really healthy, and then we just explore, have fun. But it's nothing hardcore. So even, like, a lot of people who come who actually have, like never even done yoga before, they just want to escape and you know, just have a, I guess you could say, like, a healthy lifestyle for a week, and just, you know, just get away from the craziness and just be in a beautiful place for a week.
Well, all that sounds awesome, especially, you know, like you said, the traveling and trying to live healthy. So if I am in the Pittsburgh area, there's a place called Amazing Yoga that I'm going to have to try out. Tell me what that is and how many locations and where they're at.
Well, before the whole, the fan with the pandemic, we had 4 locations. Now we have 1. So we're right in Pittsburgh and in this neighborhood called Shadyside. And, yeah, so we teach power yoga, which my wife and I, because my wife was also, she had, like, a competitive background. She was a dancer. So it's a pretty physical style of yoga. Like, it's hot, it's sweaty. So people who are into working out, like, they would probably like this kind of yoga.
Okay. And then through the lens of everything that we talked about, you know, focusing on as an ex-professional athlete and then the transition that you made out of the game, what are some last words of wisdom that you have for the listener of the show?
Yeah, I think it's just that, you know, the fine balance and like whatever you're doing. Like, you know, for me, the biggest thing that I struggled with was my identity when my career was over, and I probably spent about 4 or 5 years just stuck on the past of, like, what I should have done this, should have done that. So I think it's just, you know, just reminding ourselves that our identity is, like, we're not our job, and we're so much more than that, and just. Yeah, just trying to live life in the present moment as much as possible.
There you go. Don't let one thing define you. Find your passions in all forms and enjoy life to the fullest. Again, if you want to learn more about Sean and to sign up for a chance at a free autographed copy of Sean's book, you can head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/Sean Conley. That's SEANCONLEY. LEY, sportshistorynetwork.com/Sean Conley. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Football History Dude. To make sure you're the first to get the next episode, please subscribe on your podcast player of choice and head on over to thefootballhistorydude.com for the show notes and more information on the history of the NFL. And remember, dudes, where we're going, we don't need roads.